Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Before we start a discussion, I want to encourage everybody, which we'll do again at the end of the hour, because this is so exciting and important to all of us, that we wanted to encourage you to join us tomorrow night for our town hall meeting, the first one we've done in 3 years. We're really excited about this particular event. It's a town hall meeting on childhood obesity. We want all parents and concerned citizens to join us and attend. It's a very serious issue that we face. We really hope to – this is the beginning of a movement we want to build in our city on behalf of our children. And it's going to be a really interactive event. We're going to have tables from a number of organizations offering fitness and wellness opportunities, from community gardens to the YMCA. And actually, the Y is going to offer on-site fitness testing, and they've also donated a three-month family membership, which will be raffled off, which is worth a great deal of money. We can't say numbers like that on the air because it's public radio, but it's worth a great deal of money. And we have a number of many other raffle items. And every adult who attends will receive a lovely bag that you can fill with all sorts of giveaway items. And the University of Maryland Medical Center has just very cool water bottles they're going to give away to the first 50 people through the door to come to their table. We'll have folks there like Peter Gaskins from the University of Maryland Hospitals and Dr. Yvonne Bronner from right here at Morgan State University's School of Community Health. Chauncey Whitehead, Miss Ernestine, who is in her 70s, one of the most fit women on the planet, will get maybe off their feet. They're going to have a great deal of fun with them, who will be there as well. And there'll be plenty of time for all of you to join us and have their say at the microphone. The event's from 7 to 9 o'clock tomorrow at the Central Branch of the Enoch Pratt, 400 Cathedral Street. Please just come join us there. There'll be parking on the right around the corner for a very little bit of money, very little money. And you can become a part of a movement and keep our children healthy. So join us tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Library. For information, you can call 443-804-1252 or write to Valerie, V-A-L-E-R-I-E, at steinershow.org, or just click on steinershow.org and get some information there as well. So please join us. It's going to be a gas and very important. Right now, we are going to switch gears and take a journey in our conversations to the Middle East. My dear friend, Dr. Ali Zaghab, is once again in our studio. As I've introduced him before, he's a Palestinian-American who was born in Palestine, who was shown the Allenby Bridge when he was a young professor, but made his way to America and made well in America. And was a professor there at Birzeit University of English Literature and joins us, been joining us for the last 18 years in the air.
To talk roughly about eight, yeah.
Hopefully 18 more. We'll
I
see.
Would say, yeah. I'm a young man, yeah.
If we're lucky. And joining us for the first time is Bilal Saab, who is a research analyst working his PhD at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington. And Bilal, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Just for the record, I am no longer with the Brookings Institution. I'm just a Middle East analyst at the University of Maryland, but thank you for having me.
Oh, sure. I'll put that down so you don't miss do that again. Here we go.
That's fine.
But you are working on your PhD. We do have that right.
I am.
That's good.
That's correct. You got that one right.
Okay. So, and we'll talk about what's going on. I think that it's been interesting watching this what unfolds in the Middle East right now. And In Syria, the American response to Syria, to Libya, to Bahrain. But Syria is in the front pages now, along with Libya. And there's a complexity to Syria, I think, that we don't often get in the United States of America. I've been reading a number of articles talking about how Syria really is a nation that was a creation of the West in many ways.
All the countries in the Middle East were the division of the countries in the Middle East is a creation of the West. The Middle East has been there at least as long, if not longer, than the West. But the division of the Middle East into these little entities, you know, tribes basically living in two different countries, that is thanks to the West. Happened, you know, after basically 1914 when Sykes-Picot, the French and the British, I think they were foreign ministers or in them,
right,
decided to split the Middle East and Syria and Lebanon went to France, Jordan, Palestine, and Iraq went to England as protectorate or colonies.
So one of the things that seems to be, and Bilal, at least you jump in on this and go back to Ali and have our listeners join us at 410-319-8888, is that one of the things that I think the West is so scared of, which is one of the reasons they don't push Assad, even though he's mowing down his people and killing people in demonstrations, is because the great fear of the instability that could explode in all the neighboring countries if Syria becomes Balkanized and people start fighting each other inside of Syria. It affects Lebanon, it affects Iraq, it affects Jordan, it affects Israel. And I think the West is terrified of the balance falling apart, Bilal. Bilal, you there?
Yes. Well, that is very true. Let's be honest and say that the potential explosion of Syria, if I may use the word, could go in two ways. And one of them, you could see it in a more positive light, and the other in a far more negative light. On the positive side of things, you know, Lebanon could break free politically. As we know, Syria has had a dominating influence in Lebanon for a long time. Therefore, any collapse of the Assad regime in Damascus would have a positive effect on the course of democracy in Beirut. Perhaps the security of Iraq would improve, given the fact that the Syrian regime has extensive links to militias and politicians who do not necessarily have democratic aspirations for the future of Iraq. Also, I would add perhaps that the external network of relations that Syria enjoys, and perhaps you can describe that network as a spoiler network, if that collapses, then that could also have, potentially, I say, a good effect on the course of the peace process, the Arab-Israeli peace process. Now, on the more negative side of things, and, of course, there's a much darker view of what could happen in the event that Damascus falls. Well, you certainly alluded to it already, in that a sectarian explosion in the country, and we all know that sectarianism in Syria is a real issue. This is not something to be belittled or ignored. That sectarian explosion could have spillover effects all over the region, and specifically in Lebanon as well. And you have segmented societies all throughout the region, and you have fault lines along religious, sectarian, and political fault lines. And therefore, anything that happens in Damascus will automatically have spillover effects throughout the region.
Okay.
Ollie, what do you think?
Well, you know, I really see much more positive things happening than negatives. And I think the most positive thing is really Syria becomes a free and democratic country. Syria is one of the bigger countries in that region, about 23 million people, very educated people, and very active, you know, in commerce and for many, many centuries. The negatives that Bilal mentioned, I don't really see any negatives. Whenever you have a democracy, a free country, that is always positive regardless of what happens at the beginning. The gyrations at the beginning clearly are going to be painful, and a lot of people, like 250 or more people, have been killed in Syria so far, in Dir'a and in Jabla and other towns and even outside of Damascus. But all this, I think, is just the preliminary stages of people freeing themselves from an autocracy, from a dictatorship that has ruled Syria, really, since 1963.
Go ahead, Bilal.
Fair enough. I do want to emphasize that we're talking about two different things here. Perhaps we have an honest disagreement in terms of what could happen. And I did not say necessarily that it's all on the negative. But we have to be honest and realistic in terms of what could happen if Syria explodes. Now, nobody doubts that democracy should flourish in Syria, and the Syrian people should have a more bright and prosperous democratic future. But we really need to be careful in terms of predictions, because we've seen that very optimistic assessment play out in Iraq. We've all seen our positivism and our optimism in terms of what could happen if there were to be a more open and a more democratic government in Baghdad, that we've seen sectarianism ensue and a lot of civil conflict and a lot of violence. Now, I'm not saying that this is necessarily going to happen. I'm just saying that it is an evident byproduct of the very instability that would ensue should there be a transition from the authoritarian system that we have today in Damascus to a more democratic one. I mean, allow me to bring in a little bit of academia and scholarship into this debate, which is when you have a transitional period in a country, transitioning from an authoritarian system to a more democratic one, you are more likely, and I do not want to say it's inevitable, but you are more likely to see instability ensue for several reasons and causal mechanisms. I do not want to get into those right now, but it is really naive, at least as far as I see it, to see that there are no negatives for a collapse of political order in Damascus, at least in the near term. I do agree with my guest that in the long term, you would see a more democratic political system emerge in Damascus, and this is what we all should be supporting. But we have to be honest with ourselves and realistic that in the short term, you're going to see a lot of instability.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, I don't think that I could compare Syria to Iraq. Iraq was invaded by a foreign army, or call it foreign armies, the willing coalition, as Rumsfeld used to point out. I call them the unwilling myself. And the butchery and the murders and the mayhem that happened in Iraq because of the invasion, I don't think we'll ever see anything comparable, in whether it's in Syria or Egypt or even Libya. You know, as I said, you know, 250, 300, 500, even 1,000 people dying versus, you know, thousands versus the whole country being ransacked from antiquities that are 5,000 years old from the museums in Iraq. There's a big difference, a really big difference. Also, the schism, the religious schism that's in Iraq, I think, is a little bit different from Syria. I don't really think that the Syrians have that problem. I'm not discounting the potential for a problem. It may be there, but in the long run, any democracy beats any autocracy or dictatorship. And in the, you are a scholar in history, I think. I have never seen democratic countries waging war against each other. It's just the dictatorships that usually go to wage wars against others to suppress their people.
Well, that is very true, but until you reach that stage where you have established a mature democracy, you're going to go through some bumps, and therefore, like
oh,
I
absolutely, before, I yeah.
That transition is going to be inherently unstable. But you are absolutely correct to mention that you have a unique variable in the Iraqi experience, which was the foreign occupation, the U.S. occupation. And that in itself was an incentive for a lot of elements in Iraq to engage in political violence, something that so far you will not see in Syria simply because you do not have foreign occupation. I haven't seen or read any statements by U.S. officials hinting that there would be military intervention in Syria. However, I have a slightly different reading of the history of Syria and Iraq than yours, sir. The sectarianism, the segmented nature of the societies in both countries is pretty similar. Perhaps it is more salient and politically explosive in Iraq, given the Sunni-Shiite divide. But you still see those fault lines and divides, historically speaking, in Syria. And they have been suppressed for a very long time by the regime through the use of harsh repression. And we really are not sure what will play out in the event that political order would fall in Damascus. Again, I'm not necessarily suggesting that there would be political, acute political instability. I'm not suggesting that there would be high-intensity civil conflict, but it's certainly possible, and history suggests so.
Well, let me just throw this out here. I think that there are a couple of things. I want to wander through these countries in the Middle East and see what and get your thoughts on this and have our listeners join us at 410-319-8888. You just heard Bilal Saab, who is a Middle East research analyst at the University of Maryland, Dr. Ali Zagab, Palestinian-American, who's active in Middle Eastern affairs. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I mean, one of the things, though, I'll touch on this part of Syria before I get into the West's reaction to Syria, Libya, Bahrain,
Yemen.
Egypt, Yemen, and what's going on right now and why it is so vastly different everywhere we look. And talk a bit about the announcement just a few hours ago, the British are talking about sending troops into Libya. But going back to Syria for a moment, I mean, one of the people we're going to have on today, who is a Syrian-American scholar, but she at the last minute couldn't make it because she had a meeting she couldn't get out of. We'll have her on next week. And we're going to look to have Rami Khoury on with us next week as well from the Daily Star in Lebanon, is that Syria is a country that is being right now run by a dictatorship that is from one of the minority Shia communities.
The Alawites.
The majority of people, 70% of the Syrians, are Sunnis.
Correct.
That's correct.
Maybe 10% are Christian, and some other smaller amount are Druze, which is another whole mountain religious culture that's very ancient. And that people say if things fall apart there, the balkanization of that country could happen. The battles could begin over who has power, who takes power, and the uncle of young Assad in London wants to come back in, take over. There are other forces as well, forces on the left that have been on the in the streets, but also also Sunni forces. And so, I mean, this is what I'm saying is that the dictatorship of Assad falling could lead to democracy, or it could lead to a destabilization of the entire region.
You know, go ahead. I'm sorry, sir.
That's okay. Go ahead.
You know, well, I was saying earlier, clearly there will be problems in the beginning. You know, I remember the play Mar Assad and what happened after the French Revolution, and I mentioned that more than once before in this show and other shows.
Great play.
Clearly, you know, there are people who will take advantage of the instability and of the chaos that will take place. However, if you look at the Syrian people in general, they are some of the most educated, the best advanced people in the whole Middle East. You know, at one point, Syria was the seat of the Islamic civilization. The Islamic Caliphate was in Damascus. So Syria has a long, long history of civilization and of humanity and research and science and all that. There may be some gyration, there may be some problems here and there, but in the long run, and maybe not even in the long run, in the short run, I do believe that democracy will succeed and democracy will be good. I don't really see whether it's the Druze or the Armenians or even the Alawites in Syria trying to split the country into different Balkan states. I really doubt that, and I don't know, maybe Bilal has another idea.
Bilal Saab?
No, I do share that assessment. I think it's balanced and that's fair. I just want to spend a moment talking about this balkanization phenomenon and how it could relate to Syria. The argument itself, and let's be very clear about that, has been adopted almost, you know, in a public manner by the Assad regime. And therefore, we really should not be pushing too far with that argument because it can almost serve as a justification for the preservation of that dictatorial regime. Now, whether or not it happens is a different story that we can analyze objectively as scholars, analysts, or what have you. But to say that it could happen, and therefore what we know right now, in other words, the Assad regime, is far better than the unpredictable, is simply immoral, and quite frankly, it does not serve U.S. strategic interests. Whether it could be a byproduct of the inherent instability of the transition is something else. But we should never use that as a justification for keeping what is corrupt and is not working at present.
I think corrupt also, I didn't mention that term, I'm glad you did. I was talking to a Syrian friend of mine a couple of days back, and he tells me, and he goes to Syria quite often, at least 3-4 times a year, he tells me that the financial corruption in Syria rivals, if not exceeds, the financial corruption in Egypt under Hosni Mubarak.
It is staggering.
It is just amazing how much money the Assads and their cronies have and keeping away from the Syrian people. So democracy is very important. Freedom, liberty is very important. But also the financial corruption is staggering. And very few people here or anywhere really know about it. Of course, the Syrian people know about it, and that's, I think, why the Syrian people are revolting.
Absolutely.
So the question is that what the response of the world is to all this. I mean, we're watching the entire Middle East in large and minor ways boil up and explode. And Libya and Syria are sharing the headlines at the moment. Only in certain places is Egypt hearing the headlines. We'll talk about Egypt as well. But that – and you used the word a minute ago, what was in America's strategic interest, Bilal. I think that is interesting to watch how the West responds to each one of these – eruptions as they take place. I think, let me just posit a larger thing here. I think the West, by that I mean the U.S. government, the French, the British, the Italians even, when they do know what they're doing.
Berlusconi has other things to do. So,
don't know what to do because this is something that was completely unexpected. I mean, you had people in the U.S. government and the French government. When Tunisia first blew up, that created all this in throughout the Arab world, they were saying we should send French troops in to shore up Ali, the dictator of Tunisia, because we can't lose him.
Initially,
they did. The foreign minister resigned. The foreign minister was saying. The Americans weren't sure how to react. They were not sure how to react in Egypt, the American government. They don't know what to do about Libya. They're talking about drones and what that would do. Who knows? I mean, we had said nothing about Bahrain, about the crushing of the revolts in Bahrain. And we're not going to say anything about Assad either for a while because we're terrified of that falling apart. I think the West is completely caught off guard and does not know how to respond. The Chinese and the Russians aren't saying anything. They're burying their heads in the sand and saying, we just want it to go away. And the Chinese kind of banning any reporting at all coming out of the Middle East. They won't let any news at all come to the Chinese media. I mean, I think that people are terrified of this and don't know how to respond to it, Ali.
I also heard today in the news, and perhaps it was yesterday as well, that Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, also had some strong reservations regarding any ideas entertained by the West to assassinate Muammar al-Qaddafi, which I thought was really interesting and I wouldn't say surprising. So just to add to that divide, basically, between countries belonging to the West and Russia and perhaps China as well.
Yeah, but the U.S. did. You know, Hillary Clinton, our Secretary of State, she said the other day that there is a difference between Muammar Gaddafi and Assad. Assad, she said, is a reformer, quote unquote. And a lot of people are taking issue with what she said. I honestly, truly believe that Secretary Clinton did not mean a reformer in the full sense of the word that we know of. I think comparing him to that crazy guy in Libya, Gaddafi, anybody would be a reformer, I think. And maybe that's what she meant. She didn't have the time to expound on that or to tell people what she really exactly meant. However, I think the good news is right now the French, the British, the Spanish, even the Italian are trying to put some pressure on Syria. They are, I think, to the best of my information, I understand that all the Syrian ambassadors in these countries have been called to the foreign ministries and lectured basically about you cannot do that to your, especially to your own people. And whether they will be able to do what they, if it was up to me, I wish the Syrian revolution waited a little bit till we at least finish the Libyan revolution. Things are happening so fast, and I cannot really blame the Obama administration or even the French administration of not doing everything at the same time, because what are they going to do? We have to finish Libya first, and that guy in Libya will be finished. I'm hoping sooner than later,
I'm glad you mentioned the statement by the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, because I do agree with you that there was some confusion in terms of what she really meant. And a lot of Syrian friends of mine and analysts in here saw it as really a very unfortunate statement. Coming close to calling him a reformer is, quite frankly, a disgrace. but there's a little bit more nuance in terms of what she was really trying to accomplish with that carefully worded statement. And I may be wrong in this, but I think that what she was really trying to do is to make him responsible and bestow some responsibility on him, to basically tell him, you have a responsibility, or it's more like a test for you to actually become a reformer. And here's an opportunity for you to become a reformer. Now, whether or not that's naive or that could happen is a different story. But that, in my mind, was the main intent behind that statement. I really do not believe that the Secretary of State has a strong belief that the Syrian leader is actually a reformer. It was more like, you need to start reforming, otherwise this and that will happen.
I don't think that's very plausible also. I agree with you.
Well, I mean, we have to take a brief break. I'm going to come back and kind of challenge, push both of you a little bit here on this, because and take a contrarian position to the two of you are taking. Get our listeners to join us at that at 410-319-8888. Dr. Lisa Gubb and Bilal Saab with us talking about the Middle East and the eruptions there. 410-319-8888 is our number here. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information is available at 1-800-492-5538 or www.umm.edu/ Women's Center, or you can go to steinershow.org, our website, and click on their banner, and all the information is there. We are here in studio with Dr. Aliza Gubb, who has been on our show for the last 18 years as one of our Middle East analysts, a Palestinian-born man who has been living in this country for a long time as a businessman and was a professor of English literature at Birzeit University before he was shown the exit door of the Allenby Bridge. In the middle of the night. That's another story we'll get into again another day. Bilal Saab is with us. He is a Middle East research analyst at the University of Maryland. And the number here is 410-319-8888. Let us go to the phones first, then I'll come back with my thoughts and questions. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on the West, America, the Middle East, our reactions to it, and what's going on there, and how you think that it affects our lives here and how it's going to affect the world. I think this could be earth-shaking in many ways. And Mike, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hey, Mike. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Look, I think your guests are mystifying this concept of democracy that justify what in the good old days they called imperialism. Now we call it democracy, and we should bomb the hell out of them and send in the troops if they don't misbehave. I mean, there's all kind of examples in history where democratic societies have waged war. The U.S. was a democracy when it formally invaded Vietnam, and what happened.
Invaded where? I'm sorry.
Vietnam.
For that matter, Israel is formally a democracy when it occupies Gaza. And that's democracy having its way. The whole history of colonization is of formal democracies imposing their will on weaker peoples. If that's the context in which you view these problems, all you could do is justify U.S. conquest of weaker peoples. We have to, if we want to make this country what it's capable of becoming, we have to oppose this concept. Hillary Clinton knew damn well what she was saying. You don't obey me, I'm going to deal with you. That's what she was saying. That's what, That's what this administration is saying.
Ali?
Believe you me, I have always been very much against war, very much against the war in Iraq, the first war and the second war for that matter. And I would never welcome any foreign country intervening into the affairs of another country. However, when I see Gaddafi butchering his own people, okay, without respect to any kind of human rights, then I would welcome anybody who would try to stop that murderer from killing his own people. When I see Bashar al-Assad killing so far, the numbers that we have, at least 300 people, you know, these are Syrians who have as much right to be in Syria and to demand freedom and liberty in Syria as Bashar al-Assad himself. Of course, I welcome also other people to intervene and to help get rid of dictators of that nature.
But into what Mike was saying, though, what you just said, Ali, I mean, the United States response has been very different depending on where that is. I mean, we are not saying anything at all about the students being killed now in Tahrir Square, saying anything about the what are reported to be perhaps thousands of people who've been arrested since Mubarak has been thrown out and been imprisoned by the Egyptian army. And it's still a developing situation and things are changing, but we haven't talked about that. We never said a word about the American government about what happened in Bahrain or the majority Shia population in Bahrain asking for more democracy and freedom. We didn't say anything about Yemen until it got to the point where we had to say something to intervene in Yemen. So, I mean, it's very selective on in for what America considers its strategic interest. If it's military base in Bahrain or the strategic place that Yemen plays, we have a very selective way of determining what our policy is going to be. It certainly isn't a universal love of democracy in the Middle East, I don't think.
Bilal, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the issue of double standards in U.S. diplomacy is really nothing new. Now, if I were to limit my comments in terms of U.S. Statements regarding Syria, was it late? Was it insufficient? Absolutely. But I think the president today has changed his tone and perhaps falling short of actually calling for the ouster of the Syrian leader. But he's had some strong remarks regarding what's going on in Syria. Therefore, I think there's been, I don't want to say change in policy, because this administration and successive ones and even ones in the past have to be very careful about what they say in terms of what's going on in Syria, simply because the stability of the country affects in a direct fashion the security of Israel, which is the number one ally of the United States in the region. Before really making any radical statements, I think it is fair to assume that this administration is going to have to consult very closely with its Israeli ally in terms of statements said and in terms of actions being taken on the ground.
Absolutely. The U.S. is extremely selective. I totally agree with you, Mark. I totally admit that. I wish it was not as selective as it is. It's extremely selective when it comes to the Israelis killing the Palestinians. It's extremely. I promise you, if the Palestinians would revolt right now against the occupation, like they did in the past, I would really find it difficult to ever imagine the United States government supporting the Palestinians revolting against the occupation. You mentioned Bahrain a couple of times, and Bahrain hurts a lot with me personally. The U.S. is in a dilemma, and it's a major one. The Saudis brought their armies and their tanks into Bahrain. The U.S. could not, for strategic reasons, for oil reasons, for whatever it is, unfortunately, at this point, could not. And believe me, I do not support that policy. I wish they would say the Bahrainis also have as much right as anybody else to democracy and the freedom and liberty. And the day will come when the Bahrainis will have it. You know, as I said, it's the crescendo of things happening in the Middle East took not just the U.S., but all the European, all of us really happened just quickly from one country to the other, and we could not react. I do believe that the U.S. had the situation stabilized in Libya, and Muammar Gaddafi would be out. And then Syria, the Syrian revolt started after that. I think you would see them in support of the Syrian people in stronger terms. And then Bahrain, I do believe that sooner or later, the U.S. and the West, regardless of the military bases in Bahrain, will have to start supporting the people who are looking for freedom and democracy in Bahrain and everywhere else. The United Arab Emirates, I don't know if you heard, today, five people were arrested because on these electronic little machines were calling for democracy and electing the parliament
right.
and this and that.
Right.
So this thing is not going to end very quickly in the Middle East. But we have, you know, the dilemmas in Libya and Yemen and now in Syria. These have to be stabilized, I think, with the hopefully removal of the dictatorships before other things happen in the Middle East.
I mean, just a broader,
go ahead.
Perhaps more philosophical comment in terms of U.S. foreign policy choices. And I think it's really evident to everybody that there is a tension here between this responsibility on the part of the United States to being the police of the world, the cop of the world, and at the same time respecting and promoting the democratic aspirations of all peoples around the world. At the one point, they do not want to be the police of the world, but on the other hand, there's a very progressive and sometimes aggressive pursuit of ideals that relate to democracy everywhere in the world. And you can see that tension which is inherently between, you know, the realist impulses and more liberal impulses. And you see that being played out everywhere today, and especially in the Middle East.
I think that's true, and that's why I go back to what I was saying earlier. I mean, I think I'm perhaps a bit more cynical than either one of you about where I think the intentions of the West are in all of this. And I don't really think that people care a tinker's dam about democracy in the Middle East.
So I think I would tend to disagree with you, Mark. And believe me, I'm not, you know, I used to wear a
T-shirt.
It's good
when we disagree. I like it. We don't usually do that.
I used to wear a T-shirt. Someone is asking Gandhi, a Western journalist is asking Gandhi, what do you think of Western civilization? And Gandhi said, it wouldn't be a bad idea. You see? And honestly, truly, there's a lot, to be desired in the West. And, you know, like one reporter said, Bashar Assad was educated in London, so we expect him to be different, you know. It is this funny thing about the West, you know, and because he was educated in London, he should be different, you know. He should be treated differently. The West is overblown sometimes when it comes to their ideals of democracy and civilization. But on the other hand, I want people to help the Libyan people. I want the West, the East, anybody to help the Libyan people get rid of that 42-year-old dictator who owns Libya like it's a little ranch in Texas.
Except if you look at Libya, and the arguments on both sides in Libya is that there are people who argue and that this is more about a civil war inside of Libya at this moment.
Absolutely not, no.
That there are a lot of Libyans who support Muammar Gaddafi, support the fact that they had the highest per capita income of any nation on the continent of Africa, $14,000 a year. That they
should
had,
be $140,000
well,
a year.
They had roads, they had hospitals, and people had a stability financially they didn't have in any of the part of the Middle East. And that there are a lot of people who line up behind Gaddafi for those reasons. And this country has been split for a long time, as you mentioned on this show, and I think that Tabet Abdullah from the University of Toronto mentioned on this show recently, when you were here, I think, that Libya is a very, unlike Egypt, a very tribal society, and that's part of what we're seeing in the explosions here. This is not solely about some democratic rebels fighting Gaddafi. and it's also about the Europeans wanting to solidify that lovely oil that they need from Libya.
You know, there's nothing wrong with the oil, by the way. I don't really think it's part of commerce, and, you know, people have it and they have to sell it. But I don't think that I ever said Libya is a tribal society myself. I don't think that I ever said that.
No, I said that. Dr. Tabet Abdullah said
that. Yeah, but I disagreed with him at that point. I've been to Libya, and Libya is not a tribal society. There are so many people, quote-unquote, who were educated in the West and now who live in Libya, to talk about the West and its education. And these people are not tribal. These people are educated, cultured people who want to exercise, you know, basic rights that we take for granted in this country. You know, you could not go and vote for anybody. Gaddafi and his sons own Libya. And $14,000 in Libya, you know, Gaddafi exaggerates and he says we have about 7 million people in Libya. I think the total population of Libya doesn't exceed even 4 million at this point. With the amount of oil they're exporting and the price of oil, everybody should be getting $140,000, if not even more, instead of $14,000.
Allow me just a point of clarification.
Go ahead, Bilal.
And I could be wrong on this, but the word tribal should not be seen as condescending. Or
no, I didn't mean it that way.
Short of term.
Right.
No, just a point of clarification to what my colleague is saying. I mean, I come from a country, I'm Lebanese myself, that has high standards of education, perhaps the highest in the region, and I still see Lebanese society as being made up of tribes. That doesn't mean that they're uneducated or anything of the sort. The word tribe here is really not to denote lack of education or perhaps even underdevelopment or anything of the sort. It's just the fact that they're, you know, tribes. You can call them groups. You can call them sects or communal groups. It's pretty much the same to me. It's synonymous.
Yeah, but, you know, we're talking about the average listener here, and you mention a tribes, what do they think of?
You probably are correct to infer that perhaps they would think of it in
as something primitive and something not educated.
Bedouins, nomads who are living in tents, you know, with camels and goats and sheep. You know, that's the average listener. You know, when you mention a tribe to me, and I lived in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, I spent a lot of time in the Gulf. When I ever think of tribes, you know, it's basically even in Jordan and Palestine at one point. Tribes are tribal society is, I think, different from an educated cultural society.
Well, let me ask you, you gentlemen, another question here that is a little different. And this is something I've seen on – I was looking at my friend Mariam Shaheen, who's Palestinian living in Amman, and on her Facebook page, and it's one piece about it's personal because it's for Arabs in the Arab world to fighting for a freedom that is something that is in the gut of the Arab soul at the moment. And one of the things many people are positing that I've been talking to around the Middle East is that this is going to set off a different kind of tension inside the Arab world. No matter what happens, they can never turn back. And a lot of it has to do with women and the prominent role women have played in each one of these revolts, in each one of the demonstrations in these countries, and that the nature of the power of women and also the nature of the power of groups like the Brotherhood and other more fundamentalist groups are going to come to a head. This is also something that's creating a huge tension inside the Arab and especially the Arab-Islamic world. That is going to, I think, change the nature of those societies and cultures, especially given the role that women are playing in all of these upsurges throughout the Middle East.
I think it's very accurate, and it really is a legitimate concern in terms of empowerment of women in this democratic movement that we're seeing across the region. It really is unclear to me in terms of what role, enhanced, I may say, would women play in the societies of these countries. The leadership role has been almost minimal or non-existent in terms of who's really leading these movements. But if I may just compare it to societal movements that have led revolutions in the West, that has been a prevalent issue all over the world. It's not really limited to the Middle East. But the concern that the future, looking more democratic, and yet not empowering women as it should, is certainly valid. And we have yet to see some clear answers in terms of what role and status would women play in any future political order in the Middle East?
I think hopefully when we have full democracies, I think women will play the role that they should play, which is at least 50% of everything, if not more, maybe 51% in some cases. Under all these dictators so far, whether it's Libya, even Mubarak of Egypt, and Yemen, and most of all of them, very few, they'll have a woman as Minister of Education or Minister of Women's Affairs or whatever it is, just tokens, you know, one or two women in the whole administration. And even with that, they didn't really have that much power. I think with democracy coming in, I do believe that women will take a lion's share of the rights and the freedoms, and hopefully they will play a major role in moving these societies forward. And without women participating full steam, their societies will never advance the way they should.
I mean, I see two things here. I really want to see two things developing in the next few months and perhaps few years. And that could tell me whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic with regard to more rights for women. If there is a trend toward greater secularization of society, and the very concept of citizenship is becoming more fully developed, then I would tend to adopt a more optimistic view. But if those two trends that I just mentioned take a step back and you see a greater trend towards Islamization of societies, then I would perhaps be less optimistic.
I'm sorry, let me jump in about the Islamization. I don't ever think that Egypt will be Islamicized. I don't think that Syria will ever be. I don't think that the Palestinian people or the Jordanians or the Lebanese, and you know Lebanon better than I, although I lived there and went to school there for some time. I think we have gone beyond that Islamic mold, where freedom supersedes any kind of idea, where it supersedes even religion and religious inculcations and religious doctrinations. The Muslim Brotherhood could be a problem, I think, on one hand. On the other hand, if the Egyptian people decide they want the Muslim Brothers as their leaders, I personally would have no problems with it. Let them run for 4 or 5 years and see. If they move the country forward and they get reelected again, I'd have no problems with it. But I do not think with the dogma, if they stick to their dogma, if they stick to these radical principles, I do not think they'll be able to move the societies forward, and I do not really see them winning more than once.
And let the course of democracy happen naturally, but with regard to empowering women, if you do have a leader in Egypt or in any other country that happens to espouse Islamism or Islamist ideology, whatever that may be, then I really am not that optimistic as you are in terms of what kind of a role would women play in society. And I do agree with you that people tend to exaggerate the influence of Islamist parties, be they in Egypt, Syria, or in any other region, country in the region. But you have to also admit, and I think that's a fairly, you know, fair assumption, that those movements, those Islamist movements, are by default or by design, they're going to play a larger role in society, and they're going to have a greater say in decision-making, and therefore, by default, given the very nature of their ideologies, which is exclusivist, and it's not inclusive, and it really has not much sympathy for women's rights, I mean, I would be concluding that women's rights are going to be undermined. It's just very simple the way I see it.
Bilal Saab, you've had the last word for today. I appreciate you being a part of the show. Look forward to having you back on again. Middle East Research Analyst at the University of Maryland. It's a pleasure to meet you and have you on the air with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so
pleasure,
much.
Pleasure, Bilal.
And thank you.
Ali Zagab, always good to have you on our studios. Thank you so much for
thank you,
joining
sir,
us
for having
again.
Me. Thank you.
On our way out the door, I want to remind everybody once again to join us tomorrow night for our town hall meeting. We have not had one in over 3 years like this. This particular town hall meeting is about childhood obesity, and I encourage parents, other concerned citizens to join us there. We want to begin a movement on behalf of the children of our city. The event will be interactive. We have tables from lots of organizations offering fitness and wellness opportunities, from community gardens to the YMCA, and the Y is offering on-site fitness testing and also donating a three-month family membership for our raffle. We have a number of other raffle items, and every adult who attends receives a lovely gift bag with all sorts of wonderful giveaway items. And we'll have people from the University of Maryland Medical Center, Morgan State School of Community Public Health, like Dr. Yvonne Bronner, Chauncey Whitehead, and Miss Ernestine, the bodybuilder who is in her late 70s, will be there to get everyone on their feet. And there's plenty of time for all the participants to have their say at the mic. So join us tomorrow night, 7 to 9 p.m., at the Central Branch of the Enoch Pratt Library, 400 Cathedral Street. Come and be part of a movement to keep our children healthy. Lots of inexpensive parking right around the corner. More information, the number is 443-804-1252 or valerie@steinershow.org, or just come over and show up and join us. We look forward to having you with us tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. It'll be taped for TV and for radio, and you'll be seen on the tube, so please join us. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Cricket Aronson. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman and Akisa Gunn, who is taking over on the boards across the glass. Our music is our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Our interns today are Justin Green and Will Mason. To hear this show again, to podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.